Welcome to the Outrider Podcast with your host, Jason Quinn Mallott. The Outrider Podcast is a monthly conversation about writing and writers presented on behalf of Eunoia Solstice, a literary endeavor featuring thoughtful and provocative entertainment curated with the intent of fostering and inspiring positive social change through art. You can visit Eunoia Solstice at our website, eunoiasolstice.com, and investigate our other podcast, The Equivox Podcast, hosted by Eric Jenkins, or check out our essays, commentary, poetry, and short fiction. Now, here's Jason.
So I'm early. As of course, the intro points out, this is supposed to be a monthly podcast, but right now I'm sitting on three additional podcasts that are in the can, burning a hole in my can, and I've got another one scheduled, and I'm sending out invitations for more. So I think I can't ask people to wait 5 or 6 months for their podcast to air, so I'm going to go to every other week and see how long I can keep that up before nobody wants to talk to me anymore. So this is episode 2. Originally it was supposed to be out at the end of October, but I'm putting it out now. And today I'm talking with Gavin Pate. He's the author of The Way to Get Here from Bootstrap Publications. He also has a piece in the Warmed and Bound anthology from the Velvet website. He's in there with guys like Craig Clevenger and Stephen Graham Jones and lots of other interesting, dark, noirish writers. My girlfriend says I always say that wrong. I don't know. It sounds right in my head. Whether or not it comes out of my mouth properly, I have no idea. Anyway, Gavin and I, of course, went to Naropa University together. When we first met, I don't think we really got along. I think there was some of that, you know, male testosterone competition thing, but he was just too good to have be an enemy. So I made him my friend. Over the years, his insight and his comments and his conversations, his thoughts, his writing have been incredibly valuable to me. They've helped me become a better writer, I think. I hope I've returned the favor for Gavin. And so I think this conversation went very well after kind of a rocky early start, kind of fumbling about. I'm still new to the whole, you know, having a conversation thing, too much of a recluse. I think that's kind of why I want to try the podcast, because there are no writers that I talk to a lot in this town where I live, in Wichita, Kansas, the middle of nowhere, sort of. Anyway, let's get to it. Here's my conversation with Gavin Pate. Hey.
Hey, what's going on? Can you see me?
I can see a picture of you, but not video at the moment.
And that
that might just be a quirk of my setup with the recording here.
Okay.
So it's
I can see you. You look all official. You got the headphones on.
Oh, yeah. Got the, it's not much of a studio because it's my office here at home. And yesterday it was like a fucking lawn and garden show out back, lawn mowers and weed whackers. And I was thinking to myself, God damn, it's a good thing we rescheduled for Sunday because all we would have heard was lawn mowers.
Well, that's pretty much why I had to leave my house. You would have heard a constant chattering of children in the background and me trying to talk to you and yell at them all at the same time. So it seems relatively quiet here at my office today. Not much going on in the summer at a college. So
true. So, well, you know, we're recording, so let's jump right in. I'll kind of push us in one direction, but otherwise we're just kind of freeform with this. It's only the second one I've recorded. I talked to Jen Zukowski when I was in Colorado last week. So we're going to put a whole bunch of these in the can and then launch it in, I think, late September. So
cool.
It'll be a lot of fun. All right. So if I remember right, you're originally from Alabama, correct?
That's right. From Birmingham.
Birmingham. you grew up there, or is it just a born there? And
no, I was there until I was 18. So totally born and raised.
And how did you end up at Naropa?
I ended up at Naropa because I moved to Colorado a couple of years after college because my brother was going to CU, and I went to visit him and then didn't leave. like literally, he was living up on the hill, and I went to visit, and then I just stayed, and then started working at Mountain Sun. And I don't know if you remember Ryan Gallagher.
Yeah.
I think he was a year ahead of us at Naropa, poet. He was working at Mountain Sun. And we started talking, and he was already at Naropa. So I kind of found Naropa in one way via him. Mm-hmm. But strangely, my advisor in college had gone to Naropa in like 77. And so I knew that Naropa. So I knew it, and he had these crazy stories about being there at that time. And so I knew about it from that angle, too. So it was just kind of one of these, you know, things kind of fell together, and I checked it out and liked it. So.
And Ryan is the other half of Bootstrap, right?
That's right. Him and Derek Fenner. Okay. Yeah.
Cool. Well, that was where we met then. It was at Naropa in summer of 99. That was in Chris Baer's workshop, wasn't it? The Violence?
Yeah. I think that was one of the four, I guess, I took that summer. I think that's the one I remember from that summer. I have pretty good memories of the ones from the next. Well, you know, the second summer, I actually had some... I put some thought into choosing, and you know, you weren't the low person on the totem pole, so you kind of got the ones you wanted, right? But Chris's, I remember from that summer, and honestly, I can't remember any of the other ones I think I took that year.
Yeah.
But that was something about writing violence or sex and violence. I had a sexy title.
Yeah. That it did. So, what have you been doing since Naropa? Because I remember, I think the last time I remember being around you in Boulder was about the time of your wedding.
Right. Well, so that would have been, what year was that? That would have been 2000. 2001. That would have been 2001. Right. So I left Boulder in December of 2001, moved to Norfolk, Virginia, which is where my wife was from. She had family here. And then for the last, so what was that, 11 years ago? So since then, golly, it makes you feel so old as you start doing the addition and subtraction. But since then, I've been in Norfolk. I taught at a public school for about 2 years. I came in, you know, right before No Child Left Behind got implanted. Mm-hmm. So I had a couple of years where I could teach just because I had a master's degree. And then they figured out that I'd never taken a pedagogy class and never taken the praxis exam and never taken anything like that. And they wanted me to do all that stuff, you know, after I'd been doing it. So then I bailed on that. That didn't seem like what I wanted to do. And I started teaching at a couple of colleges in this area. And finally got on full time at Virginia Wesleyan College, where I am now, and did that for a couple of years kind of as a visiting lecturer.
Right.
And then was lucky enough a few years ago for them to for a tenure track position to kind of open up for me. So that's where I am. That's what I've been doing, raising lots of kids and just kind of living in the Hampton Roads area. So
lucky bastard.
I've had people, you know, I've now sat on hiring committees on the other side, and I recognize that I was lucky in a lot of ways. I had some things kind of, I was in the right place at the right time,
right.
because I sat on a committee last year where I think we had 200 applicants for one position.
Wow.
and they were all PhDs, every single one of them. So I feel like a couple of things fell into place. I also taught at Old Dominion University here for a good many years, probably about 4 or 5 years, and that was a good experience too. So,
yeah, it's amazing how much luck plays into what we do. I mean, I hung around in Boulder till 2004,
right,
and left because I got fired from a job for insubordination.
That's the best way to get fired.
And, you know, this was right when the economy was crappy because of the wars and
all this other stuff. And I thought to myself, I can stay in Boulder because the lease in the apartment that Laura and I shared was Laura Holly and I shared right. was almost up. I could stay in Boulder and possibly become homeless because, you know, we were kind of sick of living together.
Right.
Or I could go back home and try to find a job in Wichita. So I did that, which I can't decide which would have been the bigger, which was the, I can't decide if that was actually the bigger mistake or if I should have stayed in Boulder because I spent 9 months unemployed.
Right. Well, that homeless shelter in Boulder, you know, I worked there. It's a nice place.
So that would have
you know, in hindsight, they could have helped maybe, right? We helped a lot of people there.
Yeah.
I think I remember you doing that move and lamenting it some.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I ended up teaching for a while as an adjunct at a community college, which I think was an even bigger mistake. Because once you adjunct, and then if you do it at a community college, it's kind of like contracting leprosy for a writer.
It's interesting that you said that, because I only did one semester at the local community college, and I did it one. And then I didn't re-enroll or re-enlist to do it anymore. It seemed like, for whatever reason, there is these weird kind of hierarchies that kind of get established very quickly.
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't know what it was. I mean, there was a full-time position with that community college that opened up, and I applied for it, and they didn't even bother to interview me. And I'd been adjuncting for them for about 4 years at the time.
Right. I had the same thing happen with the Tidewater Community College. Not to throw them under the bus here, but after working and for many years putting in my adjunct time but they didn't really I don't know who they were hiring, but I know who they weren't hiring, which was me.
Have you listened to like Brad Listy's Other People podcast? Or,
you know, I just listened to that, I believe, for the first time, like maybe a week ago, and I didn't get very far into it because it was one of those things I didn't realize, you know, you need to actually have time to listen to the podcast. You can't just kind of, you know, but he had done one with Ann Carson, someone sent me that link, and I'm teaching Ann Carson this fall. So I was like, oh, well, this is great. I have this context I can maybe use this, so I'm going to go back and listen to it. But it looks like he's really hit a lot of people. I don't know.
The trend I've noticed is that he a lot of the writers he ends up talking to have the miraculous discovery story. You know, happened to be in the right place at the right time, and you know, somebody recommended them to an agent or an editor, and
right.
I just listened to one the other day where it was a woman who had been in a rock band and was touring all around, and somebody had heard one of her songs, an editor at a publishing house, and he got in touch with her and asked her if she wanted to write a book, and now she's got a book published.
There you go.
And I thought, man, I've been going about this the whole wrong way.
Yeah.
So how long was it? How long was it after you got settled in with teaching out there in Virginia that you you got that book published with Bootstrap, The Way to Get Here?
Those things, I mean, it kind of all happened almost simultaneously. I was working on that, and at that time, I think I'd quit working at the high school, and I was only adjuncting. And so I did, I think, 2 years of nothing but adjuncting. I think I was teaching like about six or seven classes a semester at three different colleges. And then I was working on that at night, I guess, because that was about the only time it was available. And then that came out in 2006, and that was the first year I got a full-time gig at Virginia Wesleyan. So it was all kind of simultaneous, which was nice. But having that actually helped a lot. I mean, helped a lot when the tenure track position actually came open, when I was no longer just a lecturer. So at least I believe it did. I believe it helped. So,
had you started that while you were at Naropa, or was that something that came out after?
No, that came out after. And I'm trying to think, I think I probably had some original drafts or ideas probably about 2003. Uh-huh. I didn't really sit down and do it until 2004. So that was in that summer. And that was coming out of being unemployed and quitting the job. I was quitting the job at the high school and not really knowing what I was doing next and those kinds of things. And, you know, having a little bit of time that summer to knock out major amounts of pages. So that was about it. But no, it didn't, you know, none of that actually came out of Naropo, interestingly enough. So
I know this is almost borderline one of the horrible questions that, that writers get asked is, you know, cause by the way, I really like this book. I don't know if I ever told you that.
You wrote a nice review of it. So thank you.
Oh, that's right. I did.
Yeah.
God, that's another sign that you're getting old. What were the inspirations behind that? What was the triggering instance?
I think for me, it was this idea, and I think this is what took me the longest to figure out how I was going to do it, but it was this idea of having this series of blackouts, right? Mm-hmm. I just had this kind of this idea like, oh, well, that's a story, right? Little did I know that that's actually not a story. There's no story there. And it took me a long time to figure out that there was no story in the fact that there was just going to be blackouts, right? That stories right. actually would require characters and other things. And so for me, that was always the thing that was hovering. That was what I wanted to write about, but I went at it, if I remember correctly, a lot of really poor ways. And it took a long time to figure out that it actually needed to have characters that were driving the story. And I think in the end, I was pretty happy with it because that kind of went into the background mm-hmm. and didn't dominate. It was no longer really a story about that, right? I mean, it was about these people. But that was, I guess, the triggering event or the first thing. The thing I walked around with in my head for a good year or so, trying to figure out how I was going to do something. With that idea. So, and, you know, you would think you learn from that experience, but right. the same thing has happened to me, you know, with the book I've been working on, which is I start with this kind of abstract grand idea and I'm trying to work my way down to like, why would I ever write about that? Right. Like, right. or how can I get that into an actual story? Right. And so, you know, you would think I'd start the other way, start at the bottom with like people having human interactions and things like that. Like the thing I tell my students they need to do.
Right. So what's the grand idea on the one you've been working on?
Well, it's shifted and changed a decent amount. But initially though, I had a line, and you know, I grew up, like you said earlier, in Birmingham. I grew up Southern Baptist. So for better or for worse, that's kind of my background
right.
in religion. And so I had this idea of the rapture coming, which is, you know, just kind of this, you know, which is a really popular idea if you're a Southern Baptist, that the rapture isn't good. But I had a feeling that if it came, it's not going to come like in the way anyone really thinks it is. And so I just had these images of people not kind of metaphorically floating into heaven, but actually floating into heaven, but things getting in the way, like shopping mall ceilings and, you know, air. So I walked around for a long time with this idea, right? That if the rapture came, what if it came in this really like kind of awkward way? Not everyone went at the same time.
Right.
People were starting to go that didn't want to go. So I had these images of people chaining themselves to things so they wouldn't go. And so again, you can't do a lot with that except for be plagued by it, right. you know, in your yeah. subconscious all the time. So I started from that idea. I've moved along, but that's of my brain that maybe that's something that I'm working on. So
what happened to, there was a short piece that you sent into that old journal that I did, the Project for a New Mythology.
Right.
Did that story end up going anywhere or did you?
Well, that story was actually part a long time ago. I think that was part of that original idea. Okay. That part of what was going to happen is if this happened, you know, kind of chaos would ensue. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that story was kind of a, you know, maybe a bit piece or a scene from this. I mean, I think that I don't want to say my problem, but when I got done with The Way to Get Here, I spent a few years trying my hardest not to rewrite that book.
Right.
Right. So, and I think what I ended up doing more than anything, at least, is learning a lot about writing stuff that, you know, you think you already know because you've written a lot and you've gone to school, but then you realize that there's all this stuff that you don't know, right? And so it was kind of this, you know, this kind of retraining of myself. Mm-hmm. And so I think of that piece as part of that process was, well, I'm going to write it in a voice that's totally different. I'm going to do things in the third person. I'm going to have this kind of frantic pace. That's how I kind of see where that piece fits in with what this larger thing was at the time. So
kind of that running down your options until everything's been eliminated except for what yes. works, right?
Right, absolutely. And and just really trying to do, I mean, I really kind of intentionally trying to do something different, because I felt like with the Way to Get Here came pretty easily once I finally got it going. Like, mm-hmm. once I finally found the voice and the character. And then I guess I became suspicious of all of that, you know, in hindsight, right? That maybe there's some things that should be more difficult to me. Maybe I need to present myself with other problems and, you know.
Yeah, I wonder about that myself sometimes, too, because, you know, since finishing The Evolution of Shadows, I feel like I've struggled a lot more to
right.
to get something done and to get it finished. Oh, there was a couple of years where I thought I should have just been a plumber and and not even bothered.
I've actually shelved two almost completed manuscripts since then. Wow. Two variations on that idea. Mm-hmm. One of them was very much about that idea of the rapture in this city where things had gone to hell, and it was supposed to be comic, except for it wasn't funny, right? There was, you know, there's always that problem, you know. I know what you mean, and I also think that you, at least for me, I just got more critical, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to fall back and do exactly the same thing. So.
Oh, right.
But.
So how far along on this one are you now?
I would say I probably have about 150 salvageable pages, mm-hmm. you know, out of a lot of other pages, but I don't really have a very coherent structure,
right.
which is problematic, but I have scenes, I have an opening, you know, I have somewhat of a projection, but I've been working on a lot of stuff simultaneously, which mm-hmm. I don't know if that's good or bad. So I've been also trying to finish up some short stories. I stayed away from short stories for a decent amount of time. And then went back to them and found them somewhat refreshing. And so I was trying to finish up enough where I would actually have a collection, which, you know, that would actually technically be a collection, right? And not just a collection of everything that I've published and everything I've written, but a collection that holds together in some, you know, where I've made choices and not just dumped my hard drive, you know, into a manuscript, right? So I've been kind of working on both those things simultaneously this summer. And I'm still really trying to figure out how to – the whole teaching – during the year thing doesn't really work for my writing very well. And so even though I've now been doing it.
Whoops, still there.
Trying to get that balance perfect of when I can put my energy in and really be productive. And then when I need to devote that same intellectual energy to something else, like grading papers or building a syllabus or, you know, things of that sort.
Right. Yeah. I've heard that a lot from a few other teaching writers that I've gotten in touch with over the years. This guy, Darren Dufresne, that teaches out here at Wichita State, has talked to me a couple of times about how difficult it is to write during the school year. And he ended up giving up one of his faculty positions as a director of something to wrestle some more writing time away from the university.
And no, I think that is, and I think it's a constant challenge. I mean, for me, you know, part of it is, you know, I'm on the tenure track, and so I want to say yes to everything, right? Someone asked me to be on a committee, or, you know, I chaired a committee, and you do things like that. And that's on top of your just everyday teaching, which takes lots of energy and for me, it uses a lot of the same parts of my brain, right? What I'm teaching really well, it's that same kind of creative, spontaneous part of me that also I use when I'm writing well. And so I think at some point for me, they drain each other. And that's not really a complaint, because I think they help each other in a lot of ways too. I learn a lot in the classroom, but But I understand what that guy's saying, that then at the end of the day and it's 9:30 or 10 and you've put the kids to bed and you're looking at the screen and you're like, where, you know, I used to be able to write till 2 and now I want to go to bed at 11.
Yeah, no, I got plenty of sleep, you know, the night before, but last night, apparently I dropped out at 8 o'clock. I thought, man, and I think part of that is that I still get up and write every morning, whether I want to or not. It's, are you still a morning writer, or does that?
Well, I am. It's by far I write. Well, I think I write the best in the morning, but, and I used to try to command that time, but, but now I just find that it's constantly interrupted and I just can't wake up early enough to like beat my children. Right? So, you know, I would need to be getting up at 4:30 or 5 to get in good to 2 good hours. And then, you know, what I find is by the time I've gotten kids to school and we've done breakfast and we've done the chaos of the morning, you know, if I get into my office, then sometimes I might have a couple of hours, you know, I might have 9 to 11 or 9 to 12 before I really have anything to do. But then, you know, the rest of your job and the rest of your life starts crowding in, which is, oh, well, here are these emails. And you know what? I didn't prep for class. That's the other one, right? Like now it's 10 o'clock and I need to read the last 100 pages of the Samuel Beckett novel, you know? So, you know, so you end up, you know, and part of that though, I mean, again, that's not really a complaint. I think that's, there are people who are better at that than I am, right? That organize their time and stuff. So, you know, you make, I mean, I think it comes down to you make choices about what you're going to spend your time doing. And then, so I try not to bitch about it later when, you know, I didn't have time to write. Well, but I did have time to like watch that baseball game. So,
well, you know, I have to admit I'm jealous. I have the regular 40-hour-a-week job and try to cram, the rest of my life around that.
Right.
Which I guess on one hand, it's not that bad. I mean, it at least gives me an incredibly stable schedule and I'm still getting up about 5:30 every morning to sit down and write. And most of the time at my job, people leave me the hell alone. 'Cause you know, if you're editing documents for engineers, they don't like to talk much.
Right.
So I don't have a lot of, you know, when I used to work at like call centers or in retail and stuff like that, there would inevitably be something stupid I said during the day. And I have the kind of mind that just obsesses over stuff.
Right.
You know, I offend somebody or say something off to somebody, you know, be rude. And I can't let that go for at least 24 hours or at least until I've had a nice, good, long sleep.
Right.
I wake up in the morning and, you know, just kind of etch-a-sketch my brain clean. But, you know, now I've got this job and it sucks up, you know, that big block of time during the day when sometimes I think my brain's just a little bit more active at about 10 o'clock than it is at 6. And so that I always am kind of like, I missed an opportunity.
Yeah.
But then again, I can come home if I'm able to hold it in my head long enough. I can get home, you know, at 5 o'clock and sit down and crank it out because I haven't, you know, spent all of that creative energy trying to come to grips with, you know, the fact that I called somebody an asshole.
Right.
That I shouldn't have, you know.
As opposed to the ones who deserve it. Right. I think it is. I mean, the whole idea of being a, you know, the whole idea of just being a writer who writes all the time, I don't know if I would be really good at that either. Right. I find sometimes when I'm busiest, I find I can be actually more productive. You know, every once in a while when I leave myself, like I'm just going to write on this day, I do a really good job at, like, you know, edging the yard. Right. You know, but if I'm trying to steal, I mean, I basically call it stealing time. When I'm stealing time, you know, well, very often I will leave, you know, I'll leave work around 4, you know, and go sit and have a beer for an hour before I go home, you know, just to kind of have that decompression. Right. And I'll manage to write 4 or 5 pages by myself, you know, sitting with the beer at the bar. And that'll be the most productive part of my day because I know, you know, the minute this hour is over, I've got to go home and start the home life, you know. And so there's this short little time, you know, where I kind of can funnel some creativity. But again, what I think, you know, especially working on something longer though, you know, working on a novel, you end up, like I said earlier, I end up with a lot of scenes and a lot of ideas and a lot of kind of fleshed out 20-page things. But finding the I guess the time it takes to tie something like that all together, right, is the challenge I keep finding myself in, right? Like, you know, I don't do the 6 and 8 hour writing days like I did maybe 10 years ago, which is, you know, those were good too. But I find if I sit around wishing I could do that, that's not particularly productive either.
Oh, not at all.
Right. That, you know, so I think you know, like, as you said, you just whatever hand you're being dealt, you just kind of, you work around it. And I guess as long as we're still writing though, that's always a good sign, right? Because I know plenty of people who kind of have gotten into this stage of their life, you know, 40, whatever, full-time jobs, families, no families. And then you ask them if they're writing and it's, I haven't written in years.
Yeah.
Right. And it's kind of like, so for better or for worse, I think.
Laura Holly.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if Laura's still writing at all.
She's not. I saw her when I was in Boulder the other week, and she's off getting a nursing degree now after getting teaching certification and spending a year in Missouri, which I think was a big mistake no matter what you're doing. And, and she wants to write. We talked about it when we had lunch. So I bribed her. You know, because with Eunoia Solstice, we want to do an annual or a biannual anthology, and we want it to be by invitation. So, open invitation to you. We want to see something by you. But I kind of, when I sat down to lunch with Laura, I said, listen, you know, my old girlfriend thinks she's a better writer than I am. And has no shame in telling people that right in front of me, which is a constant ego challenge for me. But I told Laura, I said, listen, I've got all these people lined up for the podcast, but I'm not scheduling one with you until I see a story from you for Eunoia Solstice and you start writing again.
Hopefully that will do something to kind of get her going. I mean, I wanted to send her, if I ever had a manuscript that I've, cause she made some comments on the way to get here before, it got to his final stage. So I've always, you know, I keep her in mind as someone who I would send maybe something. But I wasn't sure if she herself was doing anything. So,
yeah,
hopefully that'll work.
I hope so. Cause it's a point of sadness for me. I mean, the fact that she's not writing, cause she is so damn good.
Right.
Just the way she gets into a character's psychology and the way she twists people. That was part of the reason I made her my friend, is because that I don't want to compete with someone like that. I want to steal something from her.
Right. Right. Yeah, I know. I think we were all jockeying to sit next to her in the workshops without question.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, I was talking to Jen about it, and Jen says, well, when you see her, punch her in the face. That's like, that's a little bit extreme. And I don't think she'll want to write after that. But yeah, I think most everybody is a little disappointed that she's kind of tapered off.
Well, I figure, you know, you never know. Maybe this is just kind of a period, right? You know, I have to remind myself, you know, when I was 20, I figured I would be a famous writer by 25. And now, more often I find myself gravitating to those people who published their first books at like 45. I'm like, right. See, there's that other, you know, it's not everyone has to be, you know, the coming out of college superstar, right? I remind myself all the time that, you know, Don DeLillo didn't publish his first novel until he was almost 40. And that always kind of makes me feel, you know, like, oh, okay. And then he's had a decent career, you know, and you know, things of that nature. So
I sometimes think that's, I don't know. I hear some writers say that they don't have this comparative thing, and I want to just call bullshit on it, because I had the same things too. You know, when I was an undergrad writing, it's like, yeah, I'm going to pull a Hemingway and be published and well-known by the time I'm 26.
Right.
And first book didn't come out till I was 38. And then I've been struggling ever since to get another one done. And there's always that looking around going, well, this writer did it this way, and so maybe I can do that. You know? And so I do. I listen to stuff like Listy's podcast, and every now and then, well, I think he talked to George Saunders a while
right.
back.
Right, who was another late bloomer, all things being equal, right?
And I loved that podcast because I loved hearing about this. You know, he did all this engineering stuff and, right. you know, traveled around the world and then sat down and wrote these short stories. And now he's, you know, at the top of his game and everybody loves right. him. I thought, okay, I can settle for that narrative of my life, you know, at least at some point. You know, I think the hardest thing is that whatever it is that makes us continue to write, despite, you know, the full-time jobs or the kids and the hassle and the tweak. And I wonder what that is. I wonder if that's some kind of weird obsessive, you know, flaw, or is or is it just something competitive? So I'm not going to let, you know, X, Y, or Z get in my way. I'm not going to
right
settle for, you know, some half-assed effort.
I don't know. I mean, I guess that question would probably change from person to person. I mean, that answer would change from person to person. I think for me, at least, it's you know, I get a lot of personal satisfaction from writing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I do. You know, people talk about, oh, it's so hard and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it is. There's still all these things about it that are difficult and frustrating and you know, not great on your self-esteem and things right. of that nature. But at the end of the day, I truly, it's one of the things in my life I enjoy, and that's a pretty short list of things that really kind of give me this kind of both intellectual and, I don't know, kind of pleasure, right? And so for me, there's a lot of that, and it is obsessive. I think, I don't know any writers that aren't at least somewhat obsessive, if even about just their, you know, their sentences, right? But I think it's important for me to be able to be doing it on a daily or every other day basis, because I can really feel it when I'm not. Like, I can, my anxiety levels are different. My temper is shorter, you know what I mean? And so these are, there's that, right? And when it's going well, like, it's really, you know, it's satisfying. Now, of course, when it's going really well and then no one else realizes it's going well, that can be frustrating as you're sending things off. And you're like, but this is really good. I promise. And, yeah, yeah. But I think just, you know, I tell my students who all, you know, they, you know, they're all 20 and 21 and 22 and they're you know, they're going to be great writers at 23. And so one of the things we do in our advanced writing class is I make them finish a story and submit it. I'm like, you might as well start getting rejections,
right?
You know, start submitting things, like, do the process. So we do this whole thing, you know, we do all the stuff that they didn't do at Naropa, which is, you know, we try to talk about the professional side of right, the business. Right. You know, but part of that is to get them kind of in this idea that they're not just all by themselves, that there's this whole other side to what they're doing that they need to get in the habit. So, you know, they submit stories and they get rejections. I have them write book reviews and encourage them to submit those to places, and, you know, just kind of to get that kind of side of it besides just sitting alone at night writing in your notebook saying, oh, look how good I am, right? And you might be good. That's great. But, you know, you need a little feedback, you know?
Yeah. How, speaking of rejections, how, Did you just send it out to the way to get here to Bootstrap, or did you farm it around a little bit?
I farmed it around a little bit. I farmed it around to some agents, and in retrospect, I didn't really know what I was doing. You know, I didn't know what I was doing, and so I would probably do a different path than that. I think I sent it maybe one or two places, but then I was. You know, but then Derek and I were having a conversation and he was like, well, let me see it. I'd love to see what you've done. And so it kind of, that worked out that way. And then I was like, well, you know, that sounds great. Let's just I'm going to do that. But, yeah, you know, and I look like I know so much more about, I guess, the business side and the industry now mm-hmm. than I did then, you know, and I say this, but 2004 for me was like pre-internet. I mean, you know, it was like I was still looking. I was going to Barnes & Noble and trying to, you know, shoplift the writer's market book. You know, that thing's huge. You can't just get out the door with that either.
Right, right.
You know,
the stuff down your pants.
Yeah. So, in retrospect now, it's I view the whole industry and the whole process completely differently. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm much more aware of different publishing houses and, you know, I know who editors are by name, you know, things like that, right? So it's just different, right? And I made that joke about Naropa not really preparing us, but they didn't at all, right? There was no professional kind of mentoring.
How to
you
format,
know.
How to submit.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, I think, getting published and in terms of, you know, the other side, you know, academia, right? That, that there are things like conferences maybe you should attend, that right. something like AWP exists, right?
Yes, so, even though they were members. They've been members.
Right, but we never heard a word about it. No. Yeah. So.
Well, you know, that's definitely a valid criticism. But I think on one hand, on the other hand, there I wouldn't trade those 2 years at Naropa for anything.
No, I agree with that too. I say that I feel like they could have done that too. I guess right. that's my point, right? Like that there was a way, but they were, you know, they come from a different publishing lineage, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they were the original. You know, we got published because we all knew each other and we kind of created our own movement, right? I mean, so that's different than the old, you know, when they, you know, a lot of the people who have founded Naropa and came through Naropa, right? They were living together, right? And they were, yeah. you know, they were sleeping with each other, right? I mean, this was the way that, so how did you get published in this magazine? Well, you know, he was sleeping with her before I was,
right?
And then we had dinner together, right? So there was a lot of that going on, I think. Which is still might be a great model. It just isn't always.
Yeah, you know. It's not really conducive in the late 20th, early 21st century.
It's just different, right? Yeah. It's different. So
I mean, we can either get published or you can get AIDS. That doesn't right. really.
So,
yeah. So, have you been able to chase down any leads? Do you have anything floating around out there since the Warmed and Bound anthology? I mean, has anybody come sniffing around because of that?
Well, no, I mean, I've had some nice email exchanges with some people, and I've gotten to know, you know, in a kind of social media-ish way, a few conversations here and there with quite a few people in that book, right? So that's nice, and some of them are getting to pretty nice little levels of their own kind of success. So no, that actually has, that was a really, I liked being in there. I thought it was, it was a fun anthology to be a part of. And, and a lot of those guys are doing, I think, some good stuff. So, I mean, I keep up with a good many of them. It's got Richard Thomas. He writes all the time and is always publishing stuff. And, Stephen Graham Jones is someone who I've gotten to be friends with over the years. And he just always makes you feel like you're completely inadequate because he puts out like four books a year. But you know, so there have been some good relationships that came out of that. And, you know, and there's definitely out of that anthology, there's a group of people that I feel like whenever I finish this next manuscript, I will have, you know, some avenues. Richard's now running a small press himself mm-hmm. called, I think it's called Dark House, and they do kind of bleak thriller-ish stuff, you know, so you get these kind of connections, so right. it's nice.
That's cool. No, I think small presses, I mean, small presses are the only thing that I think is going to save American literature because Amazon's trying to kill it. I was just curious because, you know, after The Evolution of Shadows came out, it seemed like I had kind of arrived at something, but I didn't know what it was. I mean, I'd burned through like 50 agents
right.
with that one, and then finally decided to go to small presses, and the third one I sent it to was like, yeah, we'll take it. And that was, it's kind of an odd thing is that there was, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it was some flaw in my personality, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that it's a flaw in my personality, but I always felt like I was kind of way out there on my own.
Right.
And I desperately wanted somebody to help me, but I didn't either know how to ask for help or wasn't able to recognize when it was actually being offered. And so I kind of ignored it.
Right.
And
yeah, I do a lot more now. I mean, I try to consciously at least build some relationships, you know, these days with other writers or with people who are editors or things like that. Not even, I mean, beyond trying to submit things to them, but just, you know, kind of, I've done a series of interviews like for Rain Taxi, which have been actually really fun to do. Right. But it's just a good way to kind of get to know somebody, right? And then generally these are decent people who you then know afterwards and This writer, Matt Bell, who's having great success this summer, his first novel came out from Soho, and it's gotten really, really good reviews. But I did an interview with him last year, and that was, he's a good guy, and, you know, he's a serious writer. And so, you know, he kind of built, and he published me in this journal called The Collages. So, you know, you try to keep those avenues, I think, open. And that's the same thing with that Wormed and Bound anthology. I've tried to, don't just let that kind of fall into the void. I mean, if that's kind of what you're saying, right? You publish something and it just kind of like, sometimes it can just be like, well, that's it. And then there's no ripples, right? You expect right. there to be big ripples across the pond, and it was not. So I think you have to kind of create some of that stuff consciously yourself. I mean, but I understand what you're saying, that idea of being kind of alone, not knowing what you're supposed to be doing. You've written something and here you are just sitting at home with it. And where's, you know, and I'm not one, I don't really like the self-promotion, angle and things of that nature, but I think friendships and professional relationships are a good thing to try to cultivate. For anything, it makes you probably a saner person over time. Just,
I hope so. It's kind of what I'm hoping to do with the podcasting, because trying to publish something and do a journal and things like that was just way too much work.
Right.
And then, you know, I had these guys, Stephen McClurg and Eric Jenkins, who knew about the project for New Mythology, and McClurg had been in a couple of issues.
Right.
And they kind of bugged me about whether or not I was going to restart it. And that turned into Unoya Solstice, which they're mostly running with the website version, or the website, and getting people involved with that. And I don't know. I've kind of lost interest in blogging. I've lost interest in that type of writing. I think because it felt like it pulls, with the way my schedule is, it pulls me away from actually working on
fiction.
And I've been listening to WTF with Mark Maron and Listy stuff and a bunch of these other conversational podcasts. I thought, I can do that. I can do that. Right. I can sit down for an hour and talk to somebody that I want to talk to. And, you know, as long as my other components of it are in the right place, I can slap it together, put it on the hosting site and be done with it. Right. I think I can do that. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Cause you know, my ability to commit to anything aside from the next novel has been spotty since 2009.
Right.
Well, the novel and the girlfriend, it'll be 8 years together.
Wow.
Which.
It's a long time.
Well, you've been married a little longer than I've been with.
I have, just a little bit longer, like 12-ish years, something like that.
When's your anniversary coming up, or is it already?
You can't see that. Okay, first rule of podcasting is you don't just spring that question on. Right, as I talk for a minute, and then I'll say May, and so it's already passed this year. So.
Okay. But, well, you know, stuff happens.
So
whatever.
What have you been reading lately? Anything good?
Well, I have an entire bookcase dedicated to just books that I want to read.
Well, yeah,
and it's like a four-shelf bookcase, and it's full, and I'm starting to stack stuff on top of other books and in
right.
front of stuff. I mean, I recently got an e-reader, so I'm reading stuff on that. But let's see. I'm in the middle of reading The Wonder Boys.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
It's my first Chabon novel. I read some of his essays and stuff about writing.
Right.
And I found that he's, on a philosophical level, I really am kind of attracted to him and the way he thinks about stuff and the way he's approaching writing.
Right.
Because I think we've overdone the whole genre thing in this country. And it's pigeonholing people, and it's not allowing, you know, creativity, really.
Right.
You know, we've so I'm in the middle of reading that, and I'm reading Douglas Rakoff's or Rushkoff, his book Present Shock. I just started that, and I'm in the middle of his section on narrative collapse, which is
what's his name again? Douglas what?
Douglas Rushkoff. I don't have it here in the office with
That's
me.
All right.
Okay. I think I was reading it on the toilet and left it in the bathroom.
Right.
Yeah.
That's usually the sign of an important book.
Yeah.
That's what we say at our house. If it's in the bathroom, it means you're already committing to some major time with that text.
The bathroom is pretty much the only time I have to read, it feels like. And the great thing about my e-reader is it's a small little Kobo thing, because there's no way I'm buying a Kindle ever. You know, Amazon can go fuck itself. Can you tell I have an agenda?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I have this Kobo reader, and it's the Kobo Mini, so I can slip it in my pocket.
And right.
So at work, I take it into the bathroom with me.
Right.
Yes, time theft is marvelous.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, the Rushkoff thing is I've been very interested in figuring out how we as writers can do a couple of things. How do we get, it seems like it's important that we figure out how to get people interested in reading, not just reading our book, but reading in general.
Right.
I mean, that's our market. That's our, we don't have a career or a life or a profession unless people read.
Right.
And it annoys the hell out of me when you have these writers that, oh, there's nothing you can do about, people are just watching TV and this is a dying art and we're just here to entertain ourselves. And I want to grab those people and just kind of bang them against a wall a couple of times. And the other thing is, you know, how do we create a narrative that gets people engaged? Because, you know, the average reader today isn't going to sit down with something like even Mark Twain.
Right.
There's this kind of pedantic, slowly developed 19th century way of narrating a story that I think would lose people's interest right now. We've gotten so chopped up and disjointed. And how do we create a narrative that takes advantage of people's post-narrative life, you know, that's everything's all happening at once and at the same time, even if it's 15 years old.
Right.
How do we get them to sit down with a book?
I think those are important questions. I mean, I watch my children, my son's 12 and, you know, the other one's 9. And, you know, I try to encourage them to read, and I obviously encourage them to read novels and things of that nature. Also, don't try to, you know, I also don't try to be overbearing about it, because I know I figure that's the quickest way to get them not to read, right? But, you know, I think it's a lot of it is, you know, like with my oldest son, it's trying to find what it is he likes, mm-hmm. right? Like, what is the, you know, he likes series, right? Which I think is appropriate when you're 12, right? So he read The Hunger Games and he's read Harry Potter. But now he's reading, like, you know, the Orson Scott Card, the, you know, if we can forget about Mr. Card himself and just look at, like, Ender's Game. But he's reading the Ender's Game stuff and things of that nature, you know. And but then my other son has no interest in that kind of stuff, right? He wants to read books about baseball, right? And it's just, so I've bought him 800 baseball novels. Like, I didn't even know there's an industry, right? And oh, yeah. I think with adults, right, there's, you know, you see how these types of books get really popular, right? I mean, mm-hmm. all the bestseller books, and you know, they come out of nowhere. What was the trilogy that came out a few years ago? The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which was, you know, an international. And I read those. Those are fine. If that's what you want to read, it was a wonderful book on the beach. It, you know, it probably could have been edited about 200 pages out of all of them, right? Because it was a little more information than I needed. Right. But it was, you know, but I was, you know, you think that what is it that, I mean, outside the whole other question of the publishing houses and the amount of money they decide to put behind certain books, which is partially why books sell, we know that. But but also, what was the appeal here? Why at this point in time did these types of, you know, crime stories work? Or why the hell did 50 Shades of Grey do what it did, right? And this is never a book I want to read, but I'm fascinated of you know, what was that? Why, you know,
what was the zeitgeist that
That caused that.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, all over the years, you know, even though some of the stuff she chose, you know, rubbed me the wrong way, but something like Oprah's ability to at least convince people to give reading a chance, and you know, at times choosing some pretty heady books, you know, other times books that, you know, whatever, I wouldn't want to spend much time with, but, you know, so I think But I think it's hard because on one hand, you think about these ideas, right? Because that's, like you said, that's our profession. That's our livelihood. And it's important. I think we also are invested in literature, and so we have an investment in watching it be cultivated, right, over time. But on the other hand, there's what we actually do, which is you sit down and you type out these sentences, right, and how these two worlds really, in a lot of ways, don't cross over. Right. You know? So I think that's an interesting question, and the more you learn too. I mean, you made the point about the Mark Twain or the slow 19th century, mm-hmm. And if we're talking about the major publishing houses, I agree that stuff's not going to even get looked at, right? They have a, even for literary fiction, we know they have a formula they're looking for to some degree. Formula is a little too strong, but they, you know, they'll tell you, you know, agents and publishers, I can't sell this, right? That's not that your book's not good.
Right.
It's, I can't sell it. But I think that's where, thank God, you know, good small presses come in. Now, of course, very few writers are going to support themselves independently from small presses. But, you know, I find I read almost not exclusively small press books, but lots and lots of small press books. And you get that wonderful variety of people who will take a slow approach to the narrative. And it's fulfilling, right, if they're doing it well. And but that's not going to be published by, you know, Knopf, most likely. You know, so. But.
Yeah. No, I've found that most of my stuff tends to come from, most of the novels that I stumble across tend to come from small presses. You know, there are a few that still trickle down, and most of them are established writers.
Right.
And, well, it's like Chabon. Chabon's doing some interesting stuff. He's playing with genre. He's manipulating a whole bunch of expectations.
Right.
But because he was able to get in with a traditional narrative, you know,
right,
30 years ago, he's in a position now where he can completely destroy expectations and do whatever he wants and right, do it with a big house.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody new can come out with Random House these days and do that. So a lot of the interesting people are doing it on small presses, and they may or may not ever get noticed by the big houses.
But, you know, you get a guy though, like, who I think taught both of us though, you know, Laird Hunt, you know, has just because of the success, I assume, of his last book, which was up for, what was the Penn?
Penn,
right. Yeah. He's now moved, I think, to Little Brown, and that's after what? Yes. I may be misspeaking, but I believe I have that right. But that's, you know, for me, that was, I felt really great for Laird, right? I mean, because
right,
I think Coffee House is one of the great presses there.
Yeah.
But, you know, to know that he's put in, what, 5 books with them, and then, you know, let's just be frank, he's going to get paid, finally.
Yeah.
You know, Laird's going to get, they're going to write him a check, a big check, not a Coffee House check, but a Little Brown check. So it's nice to see those kind of movements, you know. I look at a guy like Brian Evanson, who still publishes with, you know, whatever, mid-sized presses. Mm-hmm. And I'm always I can't figure out why someone hasn't grabbed him up, because he's taught in all the graduate programs, right, and he's, you know, he's very influential, I think, to this next wave of younger writers. But, you know, he hasn't made that jump over to, although he was published, I believe, with Knopf at the beginning with Gordon Lish. Mm-hmm. He was one of Gordon Lish's last books that he published. But then since then, it's been all Coffee House and FC2 and those kind of places.
Yeah,
so.
That's kind of, I think what we're seeing between Laird and Brian are the two different paths that a lot of writers take these days. You know, Laird starts out with a small press and builds a following. He's able to,
right,
he's able to produce consistently.
And, right,
you know, Indiana was a fucking amazing book.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I loved that one. I've struggled with some of the other ones that he's had, but it's not out of a lack of pleasure. It's just, I think,
just not what you're wanting to read.
That's kind of not what I'm wanting to read at the time, right, but, you know, his inventiveness and his control of language is astounding. So he's built up that following, and finally with Kind One, you know, landed that little tiny bombshell, and he's off. And then if Brian did start off with a bigger house, he's taken that other route. He had the, you know, a sizable debut, and then has kind of managed to maintain that connection, but the big houses have lost interest because he didn't have that splash that they wanted.
Right. Right. Right.
And so he's had to find his way.
Well, and he's a short story writer too, you know, essentially by trade. I mean, he does have novels, but You know, I think, and I think unless you're writing a very traditional kind of American literary short story, I don't think that big houses are particularly interested in you. And Brian's stories are not the traditional anything, right? I mean, they're genre and they're dark and they're weirdly funny and, you know, so.
A lot of people look at me funny and give me a hard time about it, but I still maintain my assumption or my assertion that there is an Iowa conspiracy. It's not a manufactured, it's not a conscious conspiracy. It's just a conspiracy of circumstance.
Right.
Because Iowa is the oldest MFA program out there. They crank out lots of new MFAs every single year. And they've been doing that for what, 60, 70 years now?
Right.
And I don't think that they consciously establish an aesthetic. I don't think they consciously go out and say, we're going to exclude everybody. But I think they've managed to populate so many positions at the big publishing houses. And so many of their graduates end up teaching at other programs.
Right.
That there's this very much unconsidered preference among them for people that somehow match this aesthetic that they have established or learned from that's been built right. up. And so, you know, an editor who doesn't write anymore but went to Iowa is going to be more inclined to somebody that kind of has that same, you know, mentality or thought process or aesthetic that accidentally got inculcated to them at Iowa.
Well, I agree with that probably to some degree. And I also think that people, you know, one of the benefits of going to a place like Iowa is that when you finish there, your advisor calls the editor.
Right.
You know, I mean, and that's, you know, that's just like any, I think, profession, right? I mean, your connections help a lot. I mean,
exactly.
Being in the slush pile and being at the top of the slush pile are two totally different experiences, right? And so I think part of that kind of aesthetic that you're talking about, you know, perpetuates itself, I think, partially. And I don't really have a problem with that because I think that's just the way it is. But that if you got into Iowa and you did your time there, right, that those people, like you said, know a lot of the right people and you get a good, honest read. I mean, I think that at the end of the day is someone will read your manuscript with a different set of eyes than they maybe are going to read the next manuscript in the pile.
Right.
And you still probably have to write well enough to appeal to them. But I think we all know that, I mean, I know this when I'm just grading student papers, you know, I mean, you know, I try my best to read them all with the same pair of eyes. But if sometimes I glance up at the top of the page and you see that name and you're like, this name, and that can be a good name or a bad name, but it can change the way, you know, so it can change the way you read it if you're not careful. So,
yeah, I know. It's like I said, I don't think it's a conscious conspiracy in any way. I just think it's something that's developed, and you do, I think all it really boils down to is that, you know, somebody who went to Iowa and they see an Iowa graduate in the pile, there's a little bit, you know, an extra five pages they get.
Right. And I do agree what you said about Iowa, and maybe not just Iowa. There's a handful of institutions that do a very thorough job of filling up the other institutions' MFA programs.
Right.
So the assistant professor jobs and eventually the tenured professors, mm-hmm. you know, and so, you know, if people talk about those kind of MFA workshoppy stories, I'm never really sure exactly what they're talking about, but I kind of get the sense. But, you know, there are certain programs that do very good job at career placement. You know, I know this just though from hiring at our own position, not hiring for a creative writing job, but hiring for any position in our department. Like I said, if you have 200 applications, the first thing you're trying to do is find a way to whittle that pile down. Mm-hmm. Right. And one way you whittle it down is you look at where the people went to school.
Yeah.
Right. And you say, hey, look, I got three from Harvard. I want to put them in the let's look at these closely pile. And I got two from schools I've never heard of. I'm not going to look at that probably as closely, right? And that's just, and I think that's just, again, that's part of the system. And obviously, if you say you got your MFA at Iowa or Columbia or I think Brown or some of these really kind of, or University of Alabama, even somewhere like that, that those names kind of, you know, pop off the page at people. And you know. Right.
And I think after a certain amount of time post, you know, getting your MFA, that Iowa preference or whatever preference you're looking at, if you can stay in the game, if you can continue to write and produce,
right,
that goes away.
Right.
It's just getting past, I mean, because how many Iowa graduates have had just one novel published and then disappeared into the ether?
Right.
I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I like to be interesting to go out and count it. It's probably, I mean, just as much as there's a big percentage of Iowa graduates who are editors at the big houses, I'm pretty sure there's an equally sizable percentage of Iowa graduates who had that one book published and we've never heard from them again.
Right, right.
And, you know, so it's, yeah, I don't have the whole Star Chamber, you know, smoky,
right,
X-Files type of conspiracy idea about it, but there's definitely something going on there that you have.
Well, and I think also for the two of us going to Naropa, which had always, well, I mean, Naropa had always positioned itself from its, you know, beginnings as, mm-hmm, outside of, well, everything. We're just going to be outside, right, of everything, right? So if this is what they're doing here, then we're going to do something else. And you go back and you read the history of Naropa, it always kind of makes me laugh to know that, like, guys like Ted Berrigan and Anselm Hollow came to Naropa through Iowa. That somehow, right, in the early 70s, Iowa was hiring those guys, you know, doing what they did. Yeah. And you know, that they ended up settling in, you know, to the scene at Naropa. And so, you know, and I always like that about Naropa. It's kind of outsider status and, right, and very consciously outsider, not outsider because no one knows who we are, but very consciously looking at other ways to, you know, do education when it comes to writing and right, publishing and community building and things of that nature. So, another note, though, it's a funny thing, you know, going back to the beginning of the conversation, you know, Naropa is not a school, like, when you tell people you went there, 99% of the people just kind of glaze over. They don't know what you're talking about, right? Like, right. But my first job I got here at Old Dominion, my first teaching job, is I get a call from the guy who had submitted my application. The first thing he says to me, he goes, "You went to Naropa?" And I was like, "Why, I did." And he called me in. He's a friend of mine. His name's Grant Jenkins. He teaches at the University of Tulsa now. But Grant knew everything about Naropa. He does contemporary, wow, American, like, avant-garde poetics. That's kind, uh-huh, of his whole shtick, right? And so in that way, Naropa opened that big door for me. Right. So I always want to give them credit. Like, just their reputation at least once had preceded me.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it was good. So the people who do know, I think, really know, right? They understand what that connotation is.
Right.
But everyone else, you know, have no idea.
Oh yeah, no. I sat down to talk with Albert Goldbarth here in Wichita. He's a poet, you know, won lots of awards. He's nationally recognized. Somehow sits here in the MFA program at Wichita State. And I'd always been under the assumption that, you know, if they did know about Naropa here, they thought of it much the way one of my professors from K-State thought about Naropa, as just being a joke, something that you made, you know, stupid comments about. And I sat down to talk with Albert, and we spent about 10 minutes just kind of in this fugue state about how wonderful Anne Waldman was.
Right.
And he knows everything about her. He gets what she's about, and
right,
she's fabulous. And it's like, yeah. And I thought, and it just kind of shocked me that there are these little
pockets
of people that know what was going on out there. And they might, you know, and I think Naropa might be, from what I heard from Jen, Naropa is getting a little bit better about teaching that professional aspect.
Right.
So we might be on the verge, I think.
Well, you know, one thing I've seen, you know, now, you know, being around a lot of academics and people who are doing, you know, in the literature field, right? Some of my colleagues, you know, we really enjoy talking because they're always very impressed about the people who came through Naropa, either as our teachers or, you know, in their history, you know, and when I can talk about being there in a summer with Ondaatje and Creeley you know, the whole list of kinds of people who we had access to over
Jim
that
Carroll,
2 years.
Michael McClure. Were
there. Yeah. I mean, it was a who's who of, you know, contemporary, you know, poetics and things, mm-hmm, of that nature. So I realized that probably at the time I didn't recognize kind of how lucky I was, you know, to be in that kind of atmosphere. But as I get away from it, I see, especially as I teach a class on experimental prose, mm-hmm, and I realize how much of that class is, you know, comes out of those 2 years, right? The name, just names, just that I'd never known. So,
no, that's that. Like I said, that's the one big reason I would not trade in those 2 years at Europa for anything. Is that of all of the graduate writing programs out there, that's probably the most extensive visiting writers program in the country.
Right.
I mean, nobody gets to spend, you know, a month with, you know, 20 writers all doing visiting writers that aren't normally on your faculty.
Right. Just doing their thing around town.
Doing
for
a thing and talking about it and giving those panel lectures. You know, you don't, you know, the MFA program here at Wichita State, they bring in one visiting writer a semester.
Right.
And that one writer stays for a month. And if it's a, and with a, I think it's a 3-year program.
Right.
What is that? That's 6 writers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we our visiting writers come for like 2 days.
Right.
That's what we can do. We can put you up for 2 days and you can talk to my students for one class.
Right.
I brought Stephen Graham Jones here. And that was, I think, what he did. He taught one class, gave 2 talks.
Mm-hmm.
I think he flew in at like, you know, at noon and flew out the next day at like 6. I mean, it was very,
wow.
And that was our visiting, writing. And that was, it was great. It's a great experience, but you're right. Europa is, they just pull them in. So
can't, you know, I ended up one of those, I think it was, might've been our first year. I was hanging out with Jen. And we showed up for a reading. We got in late, so we ended up sitting in the back row with Andre Codrescu.
Right.
And this, like, bottle of Jack Daniels made it down our row.
Right. It's a different kind of school. That's what I always tell people.
I thought, no, not many people get to tell those kind of stories.
Right.
And that was the other thing that I loved about a lot of those panel discussions. You just got these wonderful detailed stories, you know, Ann and Bobby and, you know, Janine Pommy Vega and all these people sitting up on that Women of the Beat Generation panel. I think it was our second year.
I remember that. That kind of like de-evolved right in front of us, didn't it?
It just kind of became, who did you sleep with and who did you do drugs with?
Isn't that what Bobby said? I remember Bobby saying something like that to Joanne Kiger, something to the effect in the middle of the panel about who was sleeping with who. And it was like, what are we talking about? So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. I missed that. I really did. I mean, that was probably the hardest thing about going back to Boulder last week was, bopping around to places and thinking, I want to be back here and I want to do this stuff.
Yeah. My wife says it all the time. She'll wake up in the morning and say, I want to go to Dots. And I have to remind her that it's not in Norfolk. So.
Oh, yeah. Like to sit back in Mountain Sun for 5 hours with a bunch of writers again and one of those booths and just shoot the shit.
Right.
Well, I think we've got it. That was
all right,
good.
Great.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with me today, Gavin. And I'll shoot you a note when I get everything set up and we'll give you a chance if you decide to nix the whole thing. But
no, I think it'll be all right. I don't think I said anything too incriminating. So.
Well, all right. Well, thank you, sir. Let me pop this off here.
All right.
All right. So that was my conversation with Gavin Pate. Be sure to get out there and find his book, The Way to Get Here. You can get it straight from Bootstrap Productions or go through Small Press Distribution if you want to order it from your favorite local independent bookstore like Watermark Books in Wichita, Kansas. Be sure to be back in 2 weeks. We'll have my conversation with Jeffrey Goodwin. It was quite sprawling and rapid. I think you'll enjoy it. See you later.